طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with an interesting news dispatch out of Palestine, as reported by the news service Mondo Weiss. Palestinian leaders decided they will end all forms of security coordination with Israel, a much-criticized practice of shared policing across the West Bank and a staple of Israeli-Palestinian relations over the last two decades. The announcement included one loophole that would allow Israel to salvage the security arrangement, a signal that the Palestinian leaders could be seeking to leverage Israel's security concerns in order to get funds due to the Palestinian Authority that Israel has frozen. In their statement, Palestinian leaders left open the possibility that security coordination could continue so long as Israel enforces all signed agreements with the Palestinians. Moreover, ending the security coordination would not go into effect until the last 3 months from now, said Xavier Abu Eid, spokesman for the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. Palestinian leaders say Israel is in breach of the Oslo Accords for withholding their import-export revenues, over $300 million since January. Israel froze the funds after the Palestinians joined the International Criminal Court, where they can charge Israel with war crimes. For two decades, the security coordination has been a cornerstone of maintaining peace talks with Israel. Without these arrangements, the Palestinians could be inviting the Israeli army to reoccupy major Palestinian cities, though the leadership's hope is that that will not happen. And ending security coordination will force Israel to make a firm decision on supporting an independent Palestinian state. The logic is, if Palestinian security forces refuse to cooperate with Israel and do not keep a lid on protests against the Israeli military and settlements, Israel must either accept the upheaval that the Palestinian police have kept at bay or bring soldiers into the heart of the West Bank. The result would well be the start of a new Palestinian uprising, or Intifada. Originally, security coordination was considered a step in the transfer of power from Israel to the Palestinians. The slow withdrawal of Israeli soldiers in the West Bank would be accompanied by the increased presence of Palestinian security forces trained by the United States and Britain, who would take over everything from traffic enforcement to preventing a violent attack against the Israeli military and civilians. The first stage was to deploy Palestinian forces to the cities, then the villages. The last step that never came to pass would see Palestinian armed troops guarding rural lands as Israeli soldiers departed the West Bank permanently. The decision to end security coordination was made in the meeting of the West Bank's highest lawmaking body, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, Central Committee. Over the past decade, this body of 124 representatives has de facto become the Palestinian legislative branch, as the official group, is now defunct. While the Palestinians did not set any specific terms for precisely how they will change their relationship with Israel, in the past leaders have hinted there are plans waiting in the drawer. A source in the Palestinian government told Mondo Weiss that, quote, "Before the decision was taken, some governments contacted us to put pressure," unquote, "on preventing the move and indicated that the United States was one of those countries." For West Bank Palestinians, security coordination is increasingly unpopular, as many feel the arrangement assists the Israeli military in control over the occupied territory. Palestinians often refer to it as a second occupation underneath Israel's hand. Cutting ties with Israeli security forces was thought to be the last line of defense for the Palestinian government to secure a state based on the pre-1967 borders, with East Jerusalem as a capital, and the right of return for Palestinian refugees based on United Nations resolutions. The crux of the agreement is about Palestinian self-rule. Under the doctrine of security coordination, Israeli forces cannot enter Area A of the West Bank or Palestinian urban centers. In exchange, Palestinian police will prevent its own population's resistance movements and militias from reaching Israeli forces, as well as maintain general order and law. Israel has long been in noncompliance. Every week, soldiers cascade from army bases across the West Bank to urban centers and refugee camps outside their Oslo-delineated areas of operation. Palestinians feel that they never received the limited sovereignty promised to them for participating in security coordination. They think Israel alone has benefited from the deal. Still, security coordination has stood firm, despite increased tensions at the United Nations and the summer war in Gaza. As recently as last spring, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas had praised security coordination as sacred when speaking to a group of 300 Israelis at the Mukadda, the seat of government outside of Ramallah. In addition to ending security coordination, the Palestinian leaders also announced they will join more international conventions and treaties, crossing yet another red line for Israel. In a statement released yesterday, the PLO made other moves, a renewed focus on preserving historical and religious sites in East Jerusalem, in preparation for the city becoming a future capital of a Palestinian state, boycotts of Israeli goods, and the assumption of control over Hamas-run crossings into Gaza. The Palestinian leaders added in their statement that they reject, quote, the Jewishness, unquote, of the Israeli state and the state with temporary borders, and reject all formulas that will keep Israeli military and settlements on any of the land of Palestine. These are 2 points Israel sought to gain in the last round of negotiations brokered by Secretary of State John Kerry. The PLO also accepted the Palestine National Initiative, a political party headed by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, associated with the nonviolent protest movement, into the government. Moreover, the PLO set new limitations to future resolutions brought before the Security Council. The new regulations state if the Palestinians return to the United Nations, a resolution must uphold international decisions on the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, as well as time limit for ending the Israeli occupation. Last December, Palestine's Arab partner sitting on the Security Council, Jordan, proposed a resolution to end Israel's occupation by a specific deadline. The U.S. was harshly critical and voted against it. The resolution did not pass. Ambassador Samantha Power said she could not support unconstructive deadlines that take no account of Israel's legitimate security concerns. The PLO then said any new Security Council resolution should be a product of an international conference attended by Security Council members, an Arab committee, and BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The aim of this recommendation and of balking at the U.S.'s red line on setting a timetable is to shift the weight of future resolutions on Middle East peace away from the five permanent members of the Security Council. The Palestinians want to move their cause into the purview of the broader international community, where a higher percentage of countries are favorable to setting deadlines for Israel to end the occupation. We will continue to follow this high-stakes power game being played out by Israel and Palestine over the next several weeks. The feature presentation this week is a conversation between Max Blumenthal and Ali Abu Nima, held at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. The focus of the conversation is Ali Abu Nima's latest book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. It is interesting to note at the outset that Max Blumenthal, who has become persona non grata in the Jewish community since his publication of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, is once again this week the subject of censorship on a university campus. The president of the University of Paris has decided at the last minute to ban a conference that features Max. A similar cancellation occurred a few weeks ago at a conference featuring Max in Berlin. Unable to factually challenge any allegations in his critical book, the Jewish lobby is trying to silence him. It is not working. We are not able to present the entire conversation in one broadcast this morning, so we'll feature half of the conversation today and the remaining half in a future broadcast. Here are journalists and authors Max Blumenthal and Ali Abu Nima in conversation at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco in the fall of 2014.
I wanted to introduce Max Blumenthal, who is an award-winning journalist and best-selling author whose articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Daily Beast, the Nation, the Guardian, the Huffington Post, and Salon.com. Blumenthal's video documentaries have been seen on the Independent Film Channel and Al Jazeera English. His 2009 book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, is a New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestseller. His most recent book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Both his books and Ali Abu Nima's books will be on sale tonight and offer as a book signing afterward. But for now, I wanted to welcome Max Blumenthal.
Trying to check the vote at SDSU, which is having a divestment resolution.
It hasn't happened yet, but we're going to keep pressing.
But, you know, those of you who are live tweeting, you know, we're here for SDSU, SJP, in support of their divestment resolution, which is going on. Let me hear them smash and clap, whatever else noise you all can make. It's actually insane that they even have to fight to pass this resolution. It should be self-evident that such a resolution should pass to divest from corporations involved in human rights abuses. But there's one group on campus which is determined to prevent consequences for corporations which are involved in abusing and exploiting people worldwide. And it's a group that is being commissioned and orchestrated by the pro-Israel lobby. So we're going to talk about that tonight. Ali's book is one of the first books that really exposes how this whole campaign is operating, what's happening on campus, what's going to happen after the failed two-state solution, after Kerry's failed framework plan, which he actually called a framework for a framework. So this book, like Ali, is visionary. I've learned, you know, as a journalist that clear writing is a sign of clear thinking. And this book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, is really emblematic of that. It really presents clear thinking on an issue that most Americans find to be exceptionally complex. It's not very complex, as Ali illustrates. And he presents a vision for what should happen next, and he presents in very clear, accessible language how we are going to get there, how we're going to realize that vision. He answers the hard questions. One of the hardest questions, what happens to Israeli Jews once that vision of equality is realized? He offers historical context, and he offers a very humane and ethical vision, much more humane and ethical than what is being offered by the U.S. and being presented by liberal Zionists in the form of a two-state solution, which can actually, you know, be called a one-and-a-half-state solution at best. So I think, you know, in my book, Goliath doesn't present a vision. It presents...
It's kind of a nightmare.
It presents a... It does. There you go.
There we go. That's better.
And it really gives you a window into my experience working on the ground for about a year in Israel-Palestine, especially in Israeli society, especially in Jewish-Israeli society, which, unlike Ali, I have unique access to, because as a Jewish American with my special connection to Methuselah and Hem, Shem, and Japheth, I have more rights in the land of Israel-Palestine than any Palestinian in the whole world because of my J-positive blood. And I use that privilege to present you with this, what can only be described as a dystopian vision of Israel since 2009 under the control of the most right-wing government in its history, a permanent right-wing majority as long as the U.S. encouraged status quo continues. And so I think Ali's book is the perfect coda to mine because it explains where we need to go next. And it also presents, in a very detailed and forensic way, what the pro-Israel lobby is doing to prevent us from getting there, to preserve the status quo, to censor this discussion. Ali has dealt with this for far longer than I have. I don't know my audience that well here, but in New York, I mean, when you order a bagel and you want a little bit of cream cheese, you say a smear. Where you want a lot, you get a schmear. And we've been getting schmeared. Like, I was just accused of being, of inspiring these killings by a neo-Nazi in Kansas City, you know, by major pro-Israel figures, Ron Radosh, Josh Block, the former spokesperson for AIPAC. Rush Limbaugh went on the air and said that I caused him to stab three Jews. Well, he shot three people who were non-Jewish outside Jewish community centers. And there was very little evidence to back it up. But it was you know...
I'd say there's no evidence.
There was absolutely no evidence.
Give yourself a bit more credit than that, Max.
This was promoted by people paid by the Israeli government, like Avi Meyer, who is a kind of full-time social media troll with the Jewish agency. And so, you know, the smears are continuous. You know, they attempted to blame a Jew for what a Nazi did, which is very anti-Semitic to me, and very conspiratorial. I don't know, why are Zionists so conspiratorial? But this is part of how this movement is operating, because they have nothing to offer. They have no positive narrative to offer. They only have smears and censorship and even prosecution. And we're seeing legislation being introduced at the state level. And it will soon be introduced at the federal level to punish BDS. So I want to just talk about that first. You talk in your book about Israel's war on BDS and the pro-Israel movement's war on BDS. I was just in Seattle, and the Olympia Co-op has successfully defeated a slap lawsuit that was filed against it by the Israeli government. The Israeli government filed a strategic lawsuit against public participation against a cooperative board that voted to divest from Israeli products in the United States. So there are actually, the Israeli government is coming into the United States through pro-Israel groups like Stand With Us and trying to prevent Americans from exercising their democratic rights and protected speech. My question to you, and you address this question in your book, is to what extent is it working? What impact is this having?
Well, thanks, Max, and thanks to everyone. I have to say it's pretty overwhelming to be sitting up here with so many people, many friends. I see many friends in the room, and I'm really thrilled that you've come out to support us and to support the work we're doing. But you can't all be people we know. There's so many new faces here, and it's just amazing. Thank you for coming, and thank you to everyone who has worked to make this event possible. So, for those who don't know, BDS, that Max mentioned, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, it's a growing campaign. It's very simple. I mean, when you said, Max, that I tried to break things down in a simple way. One of the strategies of the Israel lobby, and I've seen this myself, you and I were both at the University of Michigan a few weeks ago, when hundreds, thousands of students were coming out to watch the student government debate a resolution on whether the University of Michigan should divest from companies that profit from Israeli occupation, Israeli militarism, and abuses of Palestinian human rights. And the students, the pro-Israel students who were coming up, and who had clearly been really well coached, were all making the same point one after another, that this issue is so complicated, don't worry your pretty little heads about it. So it's a line people have been fed that, you know, this is so complicated. And one of the things I wanted to do is really break it down and say it's not. People get this because in this country, in this city, you know, what are Israeli settlements except a more brutal and more violent form of gentrification? You know, you're taking out the wrong people, the wrong type of people, and bringing in the right type of people. That's, you know, something that we can relate to. And so for 4 years, I mean, it's going on for longer, but in the book I really trace it over the past 4 years, pro-Israel groups and the Israeli government have been pouring, I would conservatively say, tens of millions of dollars into efforts to suppress student activism, to manipulate social and cultural institutions. For example, here in San Francisco, the Israeli consulate was strategizing with the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival on how to defame Palestine solidarity activists. You know, it's everywhere. And I guess, I mean, I could ask you the question, Max. After all this effort, BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, is bigger than ever. Tonight, while we're sitting here, divestment resolutions are being debated at 3 California campuses, San Diego State University, UC Riverside, and UC Santa Barbara. Well, that's why we're checking the hashtags to see if there's a result. And so this is happening. And California passed H.R. 35 condemning this. As you said, there are laws all over the country, but repression is not working. I think the BDS train has left the station.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned you mentioned the University of Michigan. I was kind of like parachuted into the University of Michigan at the last second to be the guest speaker at their debate on divestment. And it was an incredible scene. There were 600 people in the room. No one was allowed to snap or clap. I wasn't apprised of this fact, so I come in to do my shtick, you know, and I say, make some noise for these brave students, and all I got was finger wagging. And then, you know, but they did the spirit hands. And, you know, through them, you know, pro-Israel students have learned to do this. But, you know, there are 500 students waiting outside to see this take place. And I wasn't aware of the amount of energy the pro-Israel movement was spending just at University of Michigan alone. I mean, they've had to run around from campus to campus, from city to city, to try to stop, to try to put out fires. And they, as much money as they have, and as much resources as they have, they can't seem to do it. One of the students who was leader of this divestment resolution was smeared in the Free Beacon, which is funded by Sheldon Adelson and Paul Singer, two of the biggest funders of the Republican Party, and is a neoconservative magazine in Washington, for cutting a pineapple. He had placed a photo of himself wearing a kufiyeh, cutting a pineapple, because the pineapple was the ananas was the name of a rival basketball club in Arab basketball.
I thought it was the ancient fruit of the Jewish people.
Well, why does he hate Hawaiians, is my question. And major pro-Israel figures, including Kenneth Marcus of the Brandeis Center, said that this was an anti-Semitic act, alluding to the Holocaust and cutting up Jews. I mean, if you want, I can spend, like, I don't want to waste any time explaining how he got there. But that was he pulled several muscles trying to smear this kid who, you know, had not an anti-Semitic bone in his body. The other students were accused of calling Jewish students on campus kikes, which is a word that I haven't heard since I watched Mad Men. I mean, it's not in the vocabulary of young people. These were fabricated smears. That, you know, have really created a dangerous situation on campus for these students. And the smears were being pushed by the vice president of the student council, who is a former intern for AIPAC. So they're packing these student councils with students who have been indoctrinated, who are heavily involved in pro-Israel activism. The vote was completely stacked. They got two guest speakers. One claimed that he was an impartial historian, who is a professor at the school, but I'd Googled some of his writing on Israel-Palestine, and he was, you know, about as Zionist as you can get, and he laundered all his opinions behind the Israeli narrative. So they got twice the amount of time, and in the end, the student paper endorsed BDS and said it's one of the most pressing causes of our time. They, you know, what I saw among these students was so impressive. I was just at the University of Washington where they introduced their divestment resolution. It's happening from campus to campus to campus. But you talk about the battle on campus. I mean, where is it going, and why is this significant? Because generally, these resolutions do get voted down. The Israel lobby has spent a lot of money cultivating students at the top and making sure that these votes are defeated. So what's the point of doing this?
Well, that's a great question. And in the book, I talk about an organization called the David Project. This is a multi-million dollar pro-Israel organization founded by someone called Charles Jacobs, a really virulent Islamophobe. And they got their start basically running smear campaigns against individual professors. Their first and most prominent target was Professor Joseph Massad, the brilliant Professor Joseph Massad at Columbia University. And 10 years later, their smear campaign is still running. But now what they focused on is kind of more a nationwide effort to shut down Palestine solidarity campaigns, and really even teaching an academic inquiry about Palestine and the U.S. role in supporting Israel on campus. And the reason, and I quote them in the book, the reason they're focusing on campuses is because they say that the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship is going to be decided on campus. That is where the opinions of the future generations of, you know, elites in the U.S., opinion makers, are formed. And if we don't shut this down now, in, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, it's really, you know, Israel will lose its last major sponsor, which is the United States. So the David Project lays out a strategy that includes Vicious tactics, they actually use the term, they say that we should go out and accuse professors of academic malpractice when they teach things that are displeasing to the David Project. In California, this has been happening. You know, there have been efforts to get individual professors prosecuted, for example, for using their personal websites that are hosted on California State University servers to advocate their opinions about Palestine. And professors set up their personal websites, they link to things. In fact, one professor, there was an effort by a pro-Israel group in California to have a professor prosecuted for including links to the Electronic Intifada, the website that I co-edit, on his personal website. But it's even much bigger than that. You mentioned someone called Kenneth Marcus at the Brandeis Center. What they've been doing is using the U.S. Civil Rights Act, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, to file complaints against universities claiming that administrators are allowing a pervasive atmosphere of anti-Semitism on campus. And when these complaints have been adjudicated, either by federal judges in the case of UC Berkeley, or the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education in other cases, they found them to be totally bogus. But I quote Kenneth Marcus in the book saying that, you know, even if we lose, that's okay, because we're making it such a costly personal experience for students and for faculty and for universities to get engaged in the question of Palestine, to ask questions about why the United States is supporting Israel as it ethnically cleanses Palestinians. We make it so costly personally that it's just going to deter people from doing it. And so when you mentioned that student at the University of Michigan, the goal is to make an example of him. And it's to send a message to students and say, you know, don't do this, because we're going to splash your face and your name all over the internet, and you're never going to get a job, you're never going to have any prospects. But I think the amazing thing is that people are really getting the courage to stand up to it, and particularly students. I mean, again, here, California has been ground zero for this battle. It really has. And California was where the Irvine 11, 11 students were actually put on trial for standing up and protesting during a lecture by an Israeli ambassador. They were put on trial by Orange County prosecutors who put their top homicide prosecutor on the case for students who had disrupted a speech by a government official for 5 minutes. And that's
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. I was being generous, but 2 minutes is fine.
Fair man.
And actually, you discovered, Max discovered that, because they'd made all these claims that Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador, had been so distraught by this disruption that he had to leave the speech early. Max actually reported that the reason he was in a hurry was to make it to a Lakers game. And yeah, and there was a...
I found that photo of him in the VIP lounge with Kobe Bryant.
And it was introduced at trial. But can you tell us, how distraught did Michael Oren look in that photo with Kobe Bryant?
He felt very unsafe.
But, yeah, but...
His identity was threatened.
But, you know, seriously, it's real. It's, again, what it comes down to is, I think, a realization, tacit realization at least, by Israel and pro-Israel groups, that they can't win the argument, that, you know, the game is up if we have an open debate. I mean, it's the same reason why, you know, the reaction to Goliath was to try to marginalize you, defame you. Nobody could lay a finger on this book You know, nobody, all the hit pieces that were done on Max's book Goliath, nobody could lay a finger on it factually. In fact, Eric Alterman of The Nation, when he attacked it, what did he say? What was the phrase he used about how it's all
technically factually accurate, however, it is the book of the month for the Hamas book club.
Yeah. Technically factually accurate. Okay. Let's hear it.
Welcome
for technical
to,
factual accuracy.
This is the 35th meeting of the Hamas book club, so welcome. You mentioned the Brandeis Center, no affiliation with Brandeis, institution of higher learning. I don't know if there's any higher learning going on at the Brandeis Center. It exists solely to smear people like us and attack students. They produced a 65-page paper asserting that I am, you know, a horrible human being, an anti-Semite to be blamed for everything from Miley Cyrus to restless leg syndrome. I did tip her off about the whole ratchet thing, so. No, it was 65 pages accusing me of anti-Semitism without actually questioning a single fact in my book, which is like 450 pages long, small print, so that my grandmother couldn't read it, but her new husband did read it. Anyway, this is what the Brandeis Center does, but Rebecca Pierce, who's here, wrote a really important piece for Mondo Weiss about what the ultimate agenda of the Brandeis Center and groups like this are. And she found that the Brandeis Center is working with an organization called the American Society for Trustees and Alumni, which is a very anodyne-sounding name, which is funded by the Bradley Foundation, based in Milwaukee, a right-wing foundation which funded the research that went into The Bell Curve, a book asserting that African Americans and Latinos are genetically inferior to whites. Which has funded the whole attack on affirmative action, and which is run, the American Society for Trustees and Alumni is run, I think, by Lynn Cheney, the wife of, you know, Darth Vader. And their agenda is not just to attack Palestine solidarity on campus, but to actually shut down ethnic studies, and to attack all progressives forms all progressive spaces on campus and all spaces that students of color are claiming as their own. So the issue is, when Students for Justice in Palestine is suspended and shut down as they recently were at Northeastern after a long campaign by Charles Jacobs, who Ali mentioned, and they were just reinstated after this whole campaign was exposed, when that happens, there will be one less progressive ally when they come for the rest of us. We all know where it starts. It starts with Palestine, but we don't know where it ends. And Ali's exposed that in this book. I want to go to just another issue and take it, you know, let's talk about students in Israel. Because at all of my talks, I rarely get heckled. Zionist students rarely speak up. Their talking points are easily knocked down. But there's always some group of them frantically typing in the corner, as if they type faster, then I'll be delegitimized. Or, you know, and some of them are writing in Hebrew, and I found that they've been employed by the Jewish Agency. And I've since learned that Haifa University and Tel Aviv University and the National Students Union in Israel are actually paying students to attack Palestine solidarity activists on social media and elsewhere, and they're even teaching courses on how to fight Palestine solidarity at Haifa University and Tel Aviv University. Israel has the highest rate of inequality of any OECD country, and for these students, there aren't that many opportunities. This is a good opportunity. It's a good job. So they're actually being sicked on us. Some of them have been personally assigned to me, and I know who they are, and they just won't go away. It's like herpes. And I mean,
I wouldn't know.
Yeah. Or in the Roxy Theater. So this speaks to, you know, a section in your book where you talk about greenwashing, blackwashing and brownwashing and pinkwashing I think I've heard you say, you know, greenwash, blackwash, brownwash, pinkwash, hogwash. The Marker, which is an Israeli economics publication, it reports on the Israeli economy, has found that Israel invests over $100 million a year in a washing machine to basically... So this doesn't necessarily relate to the smears, but the image that Israel projects to the outside world in this post-Oslo era of what they describe as delegitimization. So talk about the washing machine and why you thought it was important to include that in your book.
Yeah. Anyone from the Israeli consulate here tonight? Well, they're in the book. The Israeli consulate in San Francisco makes a couple of cameos.
Is it Akiva Tor?
Yeah.
Akiva, if you're here.
Yeah. But this is important because the strategy laid out by groups like the David Project and another even more influential think tank called the Re'ut Institute. I mean, it sounds arcane, but so much of the stuff that you end up seeing and hearing on the radio or in the newspaper has been planned out at these think tanks. And a really important one is the Re'ut Institute, which published a strategy in 2010, which was adopted by the Israeli government as their official strategy. It was adopted by the major pro-Israel organizations in this country. And they said, basically, the major threat to Israel today is not military. It is from a growing global Palestine solidarity movement. And the risk that Israel faces is that within a few years, it will be isolated the way apartheid South Africa was in the 1980s. So we have to fight back. So they said we have to fight back, and they identified the left, they identified liberal, progressive, and left-wing communities as their targets. And Israeli military intelligence, this is something that has been openly admitted in the Israeli press, said we're going to monitor left-wing and progressive groups around the world and monitor them for what they call anti-Israel activity. But at the same time, there's kind of a carrot and stick strategy. We already talked about the stick, you know, it's the intimidation, the lawsuits, this kind of thing. The carrot was to try to win over these progressive communities by marketing Israel, by using branding techniques to market Israel as this attractive product, particularly to young people and those perceived as progressive. So there's been a really aggressive campaign of what we call pinkwashing, which is trying to sell Israel as, you know, a haven for LGBTQ rights. Much of this is totally bogus. I mean, when you actually look at Israel's record, it's really bogus. But the idea is to align Israel in the minds of people in the United States in particular with progressive causes and thereby to win their support. And it involves, of course, it's not just saying nice things about Israel, it's bad-mouthing everyone else. It's making a lot of false claims about Palestinians. So frequently you'll see claims that gay men are routinely hanged and executed by Palestinians, which is totally false.
Caroline Glick just claimed that gays are hanged in the center of Ramallah.
Yeah, this is just absolutely untrue. There's no recorded case of this. So that's the pinkwashing strategy, and that's where the Israeli consulate has gotten directly involved, as I mentioned, with the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival in San Francisco. But it's happened around the country. And it's this use by Israel of cultural products as a government strategy that really gives rise and legitimizes the Palestinian call for cultural boycott, which says that, you know, when a government is intervening in stuff to prettify essentially apartheid, I mean, you'll hear this thing like, oh, well, you know, there's no gay pride parade in Gaza. As if that justifies keeping 1.7 million people caged in and on the edge of hunger just because they're not Jewish. You know, but that's what you're supposed to think. And with greenwashing, it's a similar strategy. Yesterday was Earth Day, and SodaStream, the Israeli company, is that the sound of carbonation? I think you need to replace your CO2 capsules. SodaStream, an Israeli company that has a factory in an illegal settlement where there's no environmental regulation, where Palestinian workers are exploited, where the very land the factory sits on has been stolen from Palestinians, is marketing itself as a green company. And the Earth Day Network, you know, endorsed it and partnered with it until Palestine Solidarity activists made some noise and Earth Day dumped SodaStream.
You have been listening to excerpts from a conversation between Max Blumenthal and Ali Abu Nima held in San Francisco. We hope to offer the remaining portion of the conversation in a future broadcast, but now we must sign off. You have been listening to This Week in Palestine, a segment of Truth and Justice Radio. We are here every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.